Normally at this time, well, Jim would be handing over to me for about half an hour of Media Watch, but this week it's a little different with me in Jim's chair, but we'll still be talking media now. And an edition of Media Watch will be going online later this morning featuring the guests we're about to hear from. And there will also be Media Watch on RNZ National after the 10pm news tonight as usual. Now, shortly, we're going to hear the remarkable story of a global giant in the PR business which managed to destroy its own reputation when it got involved in politics in South Africa.
Our view was that the work done had incited racial hatred and discontent. We commented at the time it was the most serious breach of our code of conduct in the history of the organisation, and that the board and the professional practices committee was very clear that Bell Pottinger ought to be expelled, and expelled publicly.
Well, that was an extract from the new documentary film Influence, which is screening at the Dock Edge Documentary Film Festival at the moment. And in a moment, I'll be talking to the makers of that extraordinary film. But before that, if you picked up a copy of the Sunday Star Times today, you would have noticed a special supplement tucked into it called The Forever Project Green Rebound, and it's all about climate change and sustainability. And readers of the Waikato Times, the Press and Dominion Post will have seen that already, because that came free with last Wednesday's edition of those papers. And that Forever Project content is online as well. You'll find it in the Environment section of the Stuff website. Now, the publisher Stuff launched the Forever Project earlier this year after appointing its first ever climate change editor, Eloise Gibson, and it marked the launch with the magazine in its papers on the 25th of March, but that was the day we went into level 4 lockdown, so understandably perhaps that effort to boost climate change journalism didn't make the impact they probably hoped it would have. But 3 months on, the situation has changed, and we're now just getting started on the economic recovery. And the Forever Project itself is highlighting the key question: can we bounce back from the pandemic and still save the planet? So I asked the Stuff climate change editor Eloise Gibson how COVID-19 has changed her mission.
Our theme is green rebound. We threw around a whole bunch of ideas about what should we focus on for this edition. And really, we couldn't imagine our readers wanting to read about anything else at this point. You know, COVID and the recovery from lockdown is the dominant story in every aspect of news at the moment. And, you know, climate change is no exception. So we decided to kind of take that and run with it. My feature looks at transport. I'm sure you remember, although I find I'm forgetting already, the roads were deadly quiet during lockdown, and we saw people out on their bikes, out walking, using the roads in a way that they wouldn't normally. I don't think that too many people would want to go back to lockdown transport. We didn't actually manage to really get anywhere, most of us, during that time. So it's certainly, you know, it's not something anyone would aspire to long term. But I think it did give people an opportunity to rethink.
You had this website, Quick Save the Planet, which was a kind of clearinghouse, I think, for a lot of stuff, as you mentioned, that crosses over with business, with all areas of stuff in its news. But what does this Forever Project actually add to that? What's different about this?
We now have dedicated staff, two dedicated staff, which I think adds a huge amount of depth to just, you know, the scale of what we're able to do and the attention that we're able to pay to the issue. But there's also the boss, Sinead Boucher, who's now also our owner. She has committed to cutting Stuff's corporate carbon emissions by a quarter in the next, you know, 4 or 5 years. You know, Stuff's then taking the next steps of looking at the emissions of the companies that produce things for us, as well as our own direct emissions.
Well, seeing as you mentioned a corporate element, there's also a couple of sponsors here listed, New World Supermarket Chain, Sustainable Business Network, but also The Warehouse, which have been identified with the project. If you go and look at it online, their logo's right there, front and centre. Is this a compromise? Because I'm not sure how much Stuff, I don't know a great deal about The Warehouse's own environmental policies, but I mean, a lot of stuff is imported, and a lot of stuff that might end up in landfills comes from The Warehouse. Is that really the best fit for a project such as this?
Well, firstly, I'd say, you know, landfills is largely a separate issue. I'm not diminishing it as an environmental issue, but, you know, plastic junk ending up in landfill is bad, but is not primarily a climate issue. All journalism, with very few exceptions these days, carries advertising. That is just the reality of how we still make the bulk of our money. So, you know, in order to be able to put the spotlight on the climate crisis the way that we are, we need to sell advertising. So we have commercial sponsors who want to be associated, I guess, to get the halo effect of being associated with climate change and sustainability. So they get their branding runs alongside our stories, as you've noticed. There's sponsored content in the magazine, which gets written by the commercial team. You know, the wall is still very much there between editorial and advertising.
Well, in the editorial, Eloise, that's in the edition, the second Forever Project supplement, which Star Times readers will, I guess, be seeing today if they haven't already, the heading on it here, Time to be Bold, you say, we're bringing you this magazine from a frankly incredible moment in history when politicians, all of us, listened to the evidence, then did bold things to avert catastrophe. You say, we've got to do more bold and incredible things to avoid that other catastrophe, climate turbulence. If we stuff it up, we are stuffed. We only get to do this rebuild once. But there's going to be intense pressure, isn't there, on government to boost growth, create jobs and reverse the COVID economic slump as fast as they can. It's really going to be an uphill battle, isn't it, to get sustainability at the forefront of a kind of urgent economic rescue.
I certainly wouldn't dispute that. You know, we have a government that talked up large on climate change before coming into office, and, you know, this is the single biggest test of their leadership. And I think climate has certainly not always been at the forefront of the response, sometimes for very understandable reasons. I mean, there was a health emergency, there is a jobs emergency, both of which need to be dealt with fairly urgently. It's been interesting to me watching the diversity of voices calling for a low carbon recovery. And what they seem to be saying is that this is not an either or. This is not, we build shovel-ready projects, we create jobs, or we make ourselves more resilient to the climate crisis. They're saying we can't actually afford to do both things separately. That is not going to happen. So we need to do them both at once, and let's be smart about how we do it. We have another hugely expensive transition coming to, you know, avert the worst of climate change and defend ourselves from the effects. And we don't have the money to pay for both those things separately. So, you know, the next tranches of spending will be what determines what happens here. And certainly that's a big part of what we're hoping to track over the next, you know, year or so with the Forever Project. Look at the analogy of a health reporter, right? A very good health journalist who is investigating an issue. They find that there are a large number of preventable cancer deaths in New Zealand, and that these cancer deaths are happening because of systemic failures. They will then seek to hold the politicians to account for, you know, are you doing all you can do to prevent this harm? And should you be looking out for your constituents better? That's the type of journalism I see us doing, and I see that as quite different to, you know, perhaps what you outlined just before.
Well, when you were appointed, Eloise, I can recall some people thought that they were sceptical about it because they said, well, look, here's a news organisation effectively taking a position of advocacy on a major public issue, and some saying this is actually a form of bias. I mean, some of them might be climate skeptics who, you know, feel as the media has made up its mind on this issue and a lot of the coverage isn't fair and balanced, maybe. But there will be those who disagree with your position on the importance of the climate issue as regards others, such as economic reconstruction in the post-COVID era, for example, and who would say that, you know, any findings that might contradict the things you believe in might be excluded from Stuff's coverage in order to promote sustainability. What do you say to those who say that effectively this is a kind of form of bias which is affecting the news gathering in ways that other topics, you know, the same rules wouldn't be applied?
Firstly, I mean, I think it's curious that appointing a journalist to cover the round of climate change, which I think most people would agree is one of the biggest issues of our time, and, you know, it affects the economy, affects health, affects business, affects everything, property values, that appointing dedicated journalists to cover that is biased any more than having specialised business journalists or specialised health journalists or journalists at the political gallery. I mean, you know, media organisations send their people power where there are things happening and where there are things that are important to their readers unfolding, and, you know, that's what this is. So I think it's kind of curious that that would be singled out as bias.
The entire media sector right now is under review. The government's working out how they can put together a package to help media companies survive in this post-COVID future. And, you know, for the public end of it, a new entity to replace RNZ, TVNZ is government policy, though that's up in the air. So with all these things currently being pulled apart and put back together, do you think climate emergency and sustainability need to actually be put into the government's plans for how they support media, and that rather than just put money in and leave it up to the companies to work out how they do their news gathering, that some sort of direction from them is required?
I'm not sure about that, actually. I think a lot of journalists get quite uncomfortable with the idea that the government directs the content of journalism. I think the existence of journalism certainly needs to be secured. I think journalism in general has made a pretty good case for itself being essential in all sorts of areas this year, you know, not just climate. But, you know, I'd say that I see the overall survival and security of independent journalism as being more important than having some kind of special direction or special dispensation for, you know, my little part of the ecosystem. In fact, I think, you know, that is the kind of thing that would introduce concerns about bias or, you know, undue government control. I think the health and survival of media as a whole is the important thing here.
But one of the solutions that's been put forward by some people is one thing government could do if it is going to pump some money into media survival would be to give New Zealand On Air, the government's broadcasting funding agency, a bunch of more money, the contestable funding that already exists for broadcasting. Some people are saying, look, let's beef that up a lot and cover more journalism, and that's one way of doing it. We'll use that system. So if that was to happen, do you think some of that should be tagged for projects addressing climate and sustainability?
I mean, New Zealand On Air seems to tag funding for various things now. Look, I don't know. I don't know that I would want to express a view on that. You know, I simply haven't thought deeply enough about it. I think what I would say is that readers have shown that they will click on this content. The Forever Project has had more than 5 million page views since it launched in March, and that's just on the website. So there's no problem kind of getting people to read it. I think the problem is the bigger issue of making, you know, journalism a sustainable business model. And I think, as I say, that goes far beyond climate change and probably needs a more overarching solution. I personally don't see an issue with either readers not reading the stuff or editors not, at least where I'm sitting, assigning importance to it, or, you know, or making it prominent in media coverage. So I think that part of the solution is actually probably the least of our worries at the moment. I think we're all kind of struggling, aren't we, to think of the way forward and how to make this sustainable.
Eloise Gibson, the climate change editor at Stuff and the editor of the Forever Project, which is Stuff's climate change initiative. And as we heard there, the second of the project's quarterly magazine supplements is in today's Sunday Star Times. And if you're a reader of the Waikato Times, the Dom Post or the Press, you've probably seen that already in the edition of the paper last Wednesday. And as we mentioned there, all the Forever Project content is online as well in the environment section of the Stuff website. And so go there if you want to see some more of that climate journalism that Eloise was talking about. And there's actually more of that chat with Eloise in the online version of this story that's on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website, or you'll find that in our podcast feed. Well, do let us know what you make of the Forever Project Green Rebound Edition, if you've seen it in your paper today. Text us 2101 or email us sunday@rnz.co.nz. Well, last week, most of the news about politics was coronavirus-related, and a bit of political news concerning the social media behemoth Facebook went under the radar a little, but it did make it onto Morning Report.
Facebook's making it compulsory for New Zealand politicians and parties to sign up to a transparency tool if they want to advertise in the lead up to the election in September. From next month, the website will require political advertisers here to clearly mark their advertising on the social media site. Ads referencing politicians, social issues, the elections, or political parties will need to confirm those ads, whose ads they are, and how to contact them. The ads will be stored so people can see how much they cost and who interacted with them.
Now, that's a really interesting move, and it also means that offshore interests won't be able to post ads referring to our political figures, parties, social issues, or our election during the campaign on Facebook. But during the last election, this wasn't so much of an issue here, but back then, of course, we were still finding out just what was going on in the US election the year before and the Brexit referendum before that. And it was in March 2018 that the media revealed Cambridge Analytica's illegal use of the personal Facebook data of tens of millions of people. That was for Donald Trump's presidential campaign, as well as the Leave the EU campaign in the UK. And criminal investigations into that are still going on in both the US and the UK. But in an eye-opening new documentary called Influence, the founder of the parent company of Cambridge Analytica seems to have no regrets. Sorry about that. We have to hope to play there a clip of Nigel Oakes. He's an ex-ad man and founder of the SCL Group, that was the pioneer of what he calls weaponized political data. So he founded the company and was happy for it to be used. He compared himself to an arms manufacturer like Smith & Wesson. He says, "I make the guns and the bullets. What people do with them, that's not my concern." And there was another Brit in the Influence documentary who's a master of the manipulation and persuasion game. He's been at it even longer, and that's Tim Bell. Now, he was the PR man that Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party turned to in the 1980s to win hearts and minds and votes from the British public. And for that, they made him Sir Tim Bell and later Lord Bell. He went on to found the PR firm Bell Pottinger, which became notorious for taking on international clients with shocking reputations. But it was the reputation of his own company that was pretty badly dented in 2016 when it was revealed that they received huge sums to create ad campaigns, including fake news and even fake terrorism videos during the Second Iraq War. And then, in 2017, Bell Pottinger was killed off completely after it was found out for exploiting racial tension in South Africa on behalf of the super-rich Gupta family, and that was connected heavily to South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma. So after that disaster became public, Lord Bell appeared on the BBC's Newsnight show to try and play things down a little, but in that interview, things didn't go at all according to plan.
What went wrong?
I think it can best be summed up by Walter Scott. "Elder tangled web we weave and firstly practice to deceive."
You were the man who went out to South Africa to secure this deal.
Yes. You know, this... Sorry about that.
Yeah, not a good interview for Sir Tim Bell, but he died not long after that in mid-2019. And Nigel Oakes, the founder of Cambridge Analytica's parent company, is also now terminally ill. But for the extraordinary documentary Influence, both of them agreed to talk about the work that they did in the shadows to two investigative journalists who made the film, Richard Poplack and Diana Neal from South Africa. Diana, if I could put this question to you, interesting that this epic story of what happened in South Africa under the leadership of Jacob Zuma and the Gupta family, which prompted the downfall of Bell Pottinger and Lord Bell, it came from, I guess, collaborative work between the Daily Maverick and international investigative journalists. It was done this way, and not by perhaps a major established name in South African publishing or broadcasting.
At the time, it was all a team of local journalists. It was one external person working on the team. But what was incredible about it was, you know, usually newsrooms are incredibly competitive spaces. But our editor, Branko Brickett at Daily Maverick, is a different sort of human. And he realized quite quickly, along with our publisher, essentially this was going to be a way more effective campaign or, you know, storytelling project if it was done collaboratively. And so the idea was to bring investigative journalists from Daily Maverick, from an organization called Amabungane, which is also an investigative unit here in South Africa, very very good one, and News 24, which is a big outlet here as well. And so they kind of set to work as a team and had a system of putting stories out across the three platforms. And then that, of course, was picked up by the international press, often, I might add, with very little credit from some of the bigger names, which was disappointing. But the point is that the story got out there. Had Branko not done that, I think you would have had a much a lesser effect. I think in February of the next year, Jacob Zuma, our president at the time, stepped down as president, which was an incredible sight to behold.
And Colin, if I may add, what South Africa is blessed with is some of the best investigative journalists in the world. And I very much exclude myself from that group. But there's people like Paulie van Wyk, Marianne Tam, Stefan Strummer, Susan Comrie, just stunningly good investigative journalists who know how to properly frame a story and who know how to dig deep. And we're also blessed with a small but significant portion of the population who understands the value of investigative journalism and who are willing to donate and to philanthropically back our endeavors. And I think in a way, what we've been able to find here is new models for maintaining very, very expensive investigative journalism projects because there's a portion of the population that understands the upside.
Also in the film, we see the company at work in Iraq, post-conflict Iraq, and effectively their mission there was very different. They were charged with some kind of PR nation-building exercise and the contract being worth hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, Richard, was it known at the time? The figure mentioned somewhere in there is $500 million. It's an extraordinary sum for basically public relations.
Yes, it is. And I would, the actual number was probably close to around $100 million a year. So you're talking close to $1 billion PR campaign. I'm not sure there is any other precedent for that. When they were contracted by the Pentagon, effectively what the Pentagon wanted was the usual, we're amazing campaign. But the Bell Pottinger guys on the ground said is that you want something different. What you want effectively is a nation building campaign. So now we start to walk into this gray area of weaponized communication where no one really knows who's made these adverts. No one really knows why they've been made. So off they go, these two or three commercials that they're initially contracted to make for the Iraqi television stations turns into over 600 commercials that they've made, plus a bunch of other residual campaigns. The campaign in Iraq, nobody knew about. And it was, again, dogged journalism, this time on behalf of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in the UK, that they went through a whole bunch of data pertaining to contracts that were given to British companies over the course of the war in Iraq. And Bell Pottinger had, I think, the third biggest contract. It was an astonishing amount of money. But they highlight the danger with the type of work that Bell Pottinger sold themselves as doing very well, which is high-level, weaponized, geopolitical communications.
Yeah, there's a remarkable scene in the film where there's two guys. One is an expat who was working on the project. One is a local Iraqi guy. And one says to the other, did we do propaganda? Was that what we were involved with? Simultaneously, they come up with the opposite answers. One says yes, the other one says no. And I think you could see at that point the project was kind of ridiculous. But towards the end of the film, we see Lord Bell. He is aware that he's unwell and he died not too long after. And yet he's still talking about what he did being, you know, amoral, but not immoral. And again, another figure in the film, Nigel Oakes, saying the same thing. I'm just like a weapons manufacturer. Kind of an extraordinary attitude when, I mean, that whole business is about shaping perceptions.
Diane and I actually held a webinar for our publication, Daily Maverick, here in South Africa yesterday. And I do urge your readers to look that up. It is a terrifying exposition of the kind of amorality, sociopathology, if you will, that that pertains to people who do this type of work. The people who joined and watched the webinar yesterday were horrified by Nigel's attitude to the work that he does. Hey, man. I build the weapons. What people do with them is what people do with them. It was horrifying, I think, for South African audiences to get a taste of the type of men, and most of them are men, who have meddled in elections in our country and many others over the course of the last 25 years. If Dayanan had any expectation that these two men, both of whom are dying, would take the time to really face their demons and really look at the work that they were doing in a proper light, that never happened. They remain amoral to the last.
And Colin, it goes one step further, I think, as well, in that when you listen to the language that both men employ, it's not just, oh, well, you know, we're neutral. We just make the weapons. There's a sense of providing a service or helping people. Tim often talked about helping people with problems, you know, and Nigel used similar language. You know, I'm helping to get war out of our societies and to stop people from bombing each other. So in effect, I'm doing something good for the world. And it's terrifying to think that these people who had so much power, were so influential and so well connected, in some ways really did see themselves as providing something positive for the world. And I think it just speaks volumes about the systems that have been allowed to develop around these types of people and the work that they were doing, and in many cases protect them from censure.
Well, do you actually credit, though, Diana, Lord Bell with a degree of, you know, transparency and truth-telling in his final times? Because, for example, at one point in the film, he's talking about how he famously helped Margaret Thatcher to win three elections in a row in the UK back in the 70s and 80s. And then he's talking about Rupert Murdoch. He says, Rupert Murdoch rang me up one day and said, I want you to succeed in getting her elected. Tell me what my papers should say and I'll ensure they say it. Now, this is the sort of thing that editors of his papers, even those who've been fired and left the company, do not say. They all claim that it didn't work like that, and it's not true that it's simply Murdoch calling the shots. And so do we have to credit him with actually being willing to put some things out there in the open about how that influence industry works before he died?
I think he would say things to provoke, say things that were half true or half complete. I do think that he was in a phase of his life at that point, about 18 months before he passed away, where he was reflecting. And I think he was getting quite a lot of requests for interviews, ours being the most comprehensive at the end of the day. But certainly I think he was someone who was very much in command of what he said and didn't say. At the same time, also a complex person and a complex character, which it makes him all the more interesting, of course. In that sometimes he couldn't help himself. He loved to name drop. He loved to be associated with people of power, and would readily talk about stories that perhaps might have, you know, a joke behind them or something funny to say that would make him look good. That might be more revealing of his character than perhaps he intended. And so in that way, I think I vacillate. Sometimes I think it was remarkable that he was so open. Sometimes I think that he just enjoyed to talk about himself. But I think what that reveals is, as I said, a complex person who struggled with his own ego and very often came up short, because he did love to talk about his life and his adventures, which were considerable.
Well, the other extraordinary figure in the film, Nigel Oakes, who we mentioned there, he talks about it took years to get the tactics of advertising and working out how people feel about things and to turn, you know, those into a kind of bring them to bear on politics and political discussion. But then you have him saying, now with big data, we're bringing science into this and we can turn it into an actual political weapon. And, you know, he says this quite openly. But do we now in New Zealand are coming up to an election. Facebook have just said just in the past week they're going to make political parties here use the transparency tool. So when they place Facebook advertising, the details must be clear to viewers who want to look them up. They've also said there will be no foreign purchases of ads about political issues, political parties, political personalities at that time, which is perhaps a good thing. But do we here in New Zealand need to be wary, even though we're not a major player on the world stage, that that these sorts of things could happen here?
I don't think there's any doubt that if you are, if you consider yourself a Democrat, that you should consider your elections to a degree under threat from manipulation. I mean, I don't think that's I don't think anyone should have any doubt about that. At this stage of the game, we need to be extraordinarily vigilant in how our institutions are managed. And I think that's a blanket rule that applies to any democracy. On one hand, of course, political parties and political actors have the right to persuade audiences that their point of view, that their candidates, that their policies are the best. There's no doubt about that. The question is how they go about that. Understanding now that some of these things are actual weapons. No one really knows how these weapons work. Nigel Oakes and others within the industry may insist that there are measurable sort of factors that come into play with their methodology. But Diana and I have never been able to ascertain whether or not that's true. What these weapons are very good at is sowing chaos. And that leads to outcomes that are very, very, very uncertain. There's no doubt that New Zealand should be having an argument about in this election, no doubt at all. And if the argument is managed by outside actors or by local actors who are malevolent, who are seeking to sow chaos for chaos's ends, and there's much, much money to be made in chaos, then we have a problem. And that's the status of many of our democracies right now. I deeply hope, as one of the countries holding elections in 2020, perhaps one of the most febrile and dangerous years in human history, I would like to think that New Zealanders will get it right.
Let's hope we do get it right. It was Richard Poplack, and earlier we heard from his colleague Diana Neal, the directors of the documentary film Influence, which examines the shady world of political influence for hire, and that extraordinary story of the global PR firm Bell Pottinger and how its own conduct destroyed the company and the reputation of its founder, Tim Bell. That's screening on Wednesday, July the 1st at the Documentary Edge Film Festival, which this year is online only. And I'll actually be hosting a Q&A based around the audience questions with Diana and Richard after that screening. There's details on the DocEdge website. If you're interested, that's DocEdge, all one word, .nz. And in the meantime, you can hear more from Richard and Diane and a bit more about the film in Media Watch. That'll be going out tonight after the news at 10 or on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website.